I'm going to warn some people here that are sitting close here. I may be moving a bit this time. But, just to tell you about that, I'm used to standing in these kinds of places, holding on to podiums somewhat like this. I've been doing that all my life, beginning when I was 15 years old. But usually I was let out of a door like that and brought in, and there was a judge up here, and I'd be hanging on saying I'm not guilty, but of course you know I was, and I continued to be guilty for a lot of years. So when I get up here in front of this podium, I get some of those feelings back, and that's why I like to also be in touch with you. And you give off energy, and that keeps me going. So without any further ado, I'm going to move this microphone, and I'm going to come and see you. And I got to be careful not to get too close to these speakers. That's better. All right, I feel more comfortable now. I don't do a normal sort of AA talk and tell you, for instance, that I was born in 1947, and because we'd be here a long time. And they did tell me, let me check my watch here. I gotta finish here at 8:30, so I'll make sure I do that. And if I'll see some of the guys from the treatment centers, they'll remind me, because they'll be squirming, and you can always tell when you're going overtime. To get comfortable, rather than tell you a chronological story, I'm gonna sort of tell you and try to break this talk up into. I think some speakers spend way too much time talking about how drunk they were and how long they were drunk. And I used to come to meetings like this, and I couldn't wait for the thing to end so I could run to the liquor store. And I said that when I was in Williams Lake speaking, and the speaker before me took exception to that. He was from California, one of those California speakers, you know, with the gold and the money and stuff. I'm a Lysol drinking scumbag. Let's get that straight, okay, right off the top. And he started talking about drinking Chivas Regal and how it went down his throat and what it did for him and all this stuff. And I'm sitting there, and I can just feel it and taste it, and I can't wait for him to shut up so I can get the hell out of here and get some of that stuff. Or at least my version of it, which was cheap wine usually. So I don't want to spend a whole lot of time getting people uncomfortable talking about that. But I should, just to qualify myself, tell you a story, an incident. Something that happened to me in Calgary. I could pick several cities. I'll pick Calgary. Because when I think of Calgary, I hate Calgary. I mean, I ran away from Vancouver to go to Calgary because I had my second impaired driving charge. And I don't know how to drive. And I never had a license. And I lost my license that I didn't have once for 6 months. And 2 weeks later, I was going up for my second impaired. And I didn't want to be there when the judge, you know what I'm saying? So I took off to Calgary. Now, when I was in Calgary, I was there 2 weeks. You see, I went to Calgary to avoid jail. I was in Calgary for 2 weeks. And I woke up one day in jail, and I'd stole a motorcycle. I hate motorcycles. I have no clue how to drive a motorcycle. I mean, I can't even drive a car. And I made a deal with the lawyer. And the deal was that if I copped a guilty plea, I would get 3 months. He lied to me. I got a year. And so I'm sitting in Calgary in jail for a year thinking, I left Vancouver because I didn't want to go to jail. What happened? And so I promised, you know, hey, baby, I promised myself in jail for a year that this was going to stop. I'd had enough of this crap. And I did, like, as I look around the room, I know a lot of you, and I did what I thought was best to do. I promised myself from the bottom of my heart that I wasn't going to drink anymore. And you know what happened? The day I got out, I didn't even make it uptown. That first mall, I was in there buying a bottle of vodka and getting loaded. And I ended up on the floor of the hostel in Calgary. And I ended up on that floor for a year. And when I was on the floor of that hostel, I met a bunch of other guys, just like a lot of the men that are in this room. Good guys, hardworking guys, lumberjacks, worked in the railroad, sailors, electricians, you know, all kinds of railroad guys, all kinds of good guys. And they were on the floor of the hostel with me. And all we did was drink. And I stayed there for a year, and that for me was I was trying to kill myself. I realized I'd been around AA for a long time, and I realized a guy like me just couldn't stay sober, so what the hell. Every day I drank. And I ended up drinking stuff that you can't buy in a liquor store, unfortunately. Or fortunately, I guess. A drugstore would be more where you'd find the stuff I drank. Aquavalva. Now, I used to put it on my face. I found out that you could put it in your face. And, you know, I see a couple noses turning up here. Just this is a yeah. Like, if you go back out there, you know, don't turn up your nose, because you may end up being in that place I was in. And that's all there was a bottle of Aquavalva in me, and I was sick. And I knew it would do the trick. And another thing we used to drink on the streets of Calgary was Lysol. And I used to use Lysol to clean the toilet bowl. But I found out that it could clean up your guts pretty good too and do wonderful stuff for your head. And like, let's be serious. Lysol is the best bargain one can get if you're an alcoholic. I mean, it is. I figured it out. When you go to the liquor store and you're drinking, you get the most alcohol for the cheapest amount of money, right? That's how you figure it out. Well, Lysol is 60-some% alcohol. Dollar for dollar, it's the best buy there is. No, it is. Somebody here doesn't believe me, and I think, you know, I see this guy shaking his head, and it's like, he probably drinks tequila. Tequila with a worm in it. You get my message? So when I was on the floor of this hostel, I also used to get picked up by the police a lot for impaired walking, and sometimes I get caught stealing stuff, because you have to steal stuff in order to drink. Totem poles are good to steal if you look like me. I'd steal totem poles. There was one place in Calgary where the tower is, they had a whole wall of Indian shit, you know what I'm saying? I used to steal all kinds of it and tell guys that I was a carver and stuff. You know? And I'd worked a month on this piece. And he saw the stamp on the bottom and kind of shake his head, you know? But while I was on that floor, I lost my train of thought here. Oh yeah. I woke up one day. Now, I used to go to a place, I didn't do laundry, because laundry cost money. I go to the missions and stuff and just throw my shirts off and get new ones. And so this particular day, I've been sober for quite a while, about 3 days, and decided I was going to get all cleaned up. And I went to this charity place and got some new clothes, and I had a nice light blue shirt, and I got some matching strides. And, you know, I looked pretty good. I was ready to go. And I'd robbed somebody earlier, and so I had a few dollars in my pocket, and I was going uptown. And about 3 days later, I woke up in this jail cell. And what was different about this was normally I was in the drunk tank. Now, I don't know if any of you have been in drunk tanks. I know Jimmy has. The drunk tank in Calgary was notorious in those years because it was Crane City in Calgary. They were just building it. And there were just thousands of men working, building those skyscrapers and stuff. So it was a busy city, and there was lots of money. And so they'd be like drunks. There's enough room. I'd been there so often, I knew this, for 14 guys on the floor, and every space was covered. But those cops, those police officer gentlemen, now that I'm recovered, I call them nice things. Those cops would throw extra bodies in, so they'd stack us. And normally, I knew when I was in the drunk tank, because I'd wake up and there'd be a face, a foot in my face, and there'd be another foot in my crotch, and there'd be like, and there'd be that putrid smell of rotten men. You know that smell, that sour, sweet smell? It's horrible. This guy's definitely been there, this guy right here. But this particular morning, or whatever it was, I woke up and I was in a single cell. And I thought, hey, this is the big time now. I like this. They know who I am. And what happened, though, was as I was looking, I realized I must be charged with something other than drunk. And as I was looking around, checking myself out, I noticed, like when I started this drunk, I was looking good. Now my light blue shirt was all caked in blood. And my light pants were all caked in blood. So I did what we'd all do. I checked myself out to make sure it wasn't mine. I looked okay. And then I thought, my God, I wonder whose it is if it ain't mine. And there seems to be a lot of them. This guy was sloppy. So that bothered me. So I called the guard over. And I said, excuse me, officer. That's not what I said, but it sounds good. Hey, you pig, what am I charged with? And he said, well, Gladstone, it's the big one. It's the big one, man. And he just turned around and walked away. Now, all of it if you're loaded. And I certainly have. And I thought, my God, the horror of being out there. You know, we all worry about that. Us men, we do anyway. That we don't kill somebody. And I thought, my God, I've done it. So, just about that time, I was standing up. I couldn't stand up anymore. Fear just went through me, and I had no, my knees gave up. I had to sit down on that cot. And as I'm sitting on that cot, I'm thinking to myself, my God, who did I kill? I hope it's somebody I don't know. I hope it's somebody that's an enemy of mine, not a friend. I hope it's not a woman. And as I was thinking of likely candidates, they called my name, and I couldn't stand up. And I said, I can't stand up. So these two bold guards looked at each other, and they came in and they got me. They picked me up and they walked me into the courtroom, much like this podium deal. And I was hanging on to it, just shaking. And the prosecutor stood up with a sheet of paper there and he said, on or about in the province of Alberta, did you commit the crime of theft under and steal a 6-pound roast beef?
I said, "Don't pray! Don't pray! I'm not thief! I was never so happy to be a thief in all my life." And what had happened is in Safeway, I used to steal a lot of meat, you know what I'm saying? Like, you can always sell meat. You'd buy meat, right? You know, because it's so expensive. Even honest people will buy hot meat, you know what I'm saying? I should tell you, as I walk up and down here, I got new choppers. And the last time I had new choppers, I was giving a talk like this, and I forget what I was saying. I think I was screaming about freedom or something, and my teeth went flying out. So if you feel anything warm in your lap, it's my teeth. Just hold on to them for me. Yeah. Trust me. So I was in Calgary. I went to a treatment center. I used to, you know what happens, we continue to drink, and a lot of us get to a place where we have this problem that becomes very noticeable. And the problem is we have, as I figured it out, we have a problem in hearing. We don't hear. Because for all the meetings you go to, you will hear. You will hear how it works at every meeting. And how it works is not just the title of the fifth chapter. How it works actually is how it works. No, it is. No. But it took me 13 and a half years to figure out how it works is how it works. And I used to think I was pretty smart. Too smart. And so my problem is that I don't hear. Now, I know as I look around the room, I've had the pleasure of meeting a lot of you men in another situation, and that is in the treatment center environment. And what happens, I've seen some of you several times in that environment, back and forth and back and forth. Now, I won't ask this, if we have anybody here who has relapsed, like I won't, don't put up their hand. Last time they did that, it was like a wave just about knocking over all the people who had relapsed. And what we have to understand is that if you've relapsed, you are definitely, definitely, without a doubt, in the right place. Because I relapsed for 13 and a half years. I became a professional. And like a cop asked me one time when he was arresting me, second time that day, I think it was, and he said, "Lloyd, what is it you do?" I said, "Well, I'm glad you asked. I'm a professional. Professional client. I get sick and then I get well. And then I get sick and then I get well. Usually around welfare day is when I start getting sick." And so I became a professional client. And that's the way I live. And for some of you, as I look around, I know some of you are just apprenticing. And I'm getting worried. Because things are changing out there. The world is changing. This is the year 2000, beginning of the millennium. And it's a different world. The street is different than it was when I was doing my thing. You know, Pigeon Park is one of my favorite spots. I just love Pigeon Park. It's so busy now. Like nowadays, it's busy 24 hours a day. In my time, it was only busy till about midnight. And then the drunks just passed out. But now they got all these guys doing this other wacky shit, but they're just going all the time. They go 24/7. They just keep going. And what happens, and then some of them are falling asleep like real early, and I can't figure that out either. Because they're doing other stuff. And they're passed out by noon, or 6 in the morning, or whatever. And the ambulances are going down there a lot more often than they used to. And people are dying in that part. As a matter of fact, I almost did myself. But it wasn't because of that stuff. It was like, this is AA, right? This is a drinking thing here. And there was a time, I used to be a bartender and work in the restaurant business. I don't know if I'm going to get into that tonight, but I just want you to know this, just to clarify something here. I'm a Chivas Regal kind of drinker. I guess you can tell that by the way I look, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'd heard that a guy could, for $2, get a bottle of Chinese wine, and it would do the trick. The only problem with it was it was a little salty. So ideally, it'd be nice to have some French fries or something, I guess. I don't know. But I'd heard that, man. I'd kept that in the back of my mind. And this particular day, you know, this is the thing about the yets. You know, like, if you haven't done any of this stuff yet, just keep drinking. If you've got a job and you keep drinking, you'll start to know what it's like not to have a job and get to a place where you can't go get a job. If you've got a lady on your arm, you'll get to a place where it don't matter because you couldn't perform even if you wanted to. You know, all the money I used to waste on girls walking in the bars with all kinds of money and spending money on these ladies, buying drinks and stuff. You know, she'd say to me, let's go, boy. I'd say, well, okay, sweetheart, but we're just gonna have one more. And I never made it. Sometimes I'd even bring them home. And I'd wake up and they were gone and I still had all my clothes on. And I knew nothing happened. But of course, I wouldn't tell anybody that. Well, you do look familiar. I lost my train of thought now. I need to start talking. Oh yeah, I was telling you about Pigeon Park. Telling you my problem is that I can't hear. I couldn't hear. And the Chinese wine. So this particular day I had $4 in my pocket. I was walking uptown because a friend of mine was a DJ at CFRO Radio, which is incidentally just above Pigeon Park in that building. It's on the 3rd or 4th floor. And I was going up to see him. And on the way, I was pretty sick. And I thought, my God, how can I get a drink? On Sundays, in those days, you couldn't buy any booze. And so I thought, well, I'll just maybe go down through Chinatown and see what's happening down there. And I had this Chinese wine in the back of my mind. I walked into one of the stores, and they had a special. They had Chinese wine for $1.99. And so I bought 2 bottles of Chinese wine. I went down by the waterfront and opened that first bottle. And I know from drinking moose milk. Anybody here drink moose milk?
Yeah.
Okay, well, moose. Just stay sober. Moose milk is rubbing alcohol in water. It looks like milk. Anyway, this Chinese wine, I took a drink of that, and I know you got to open your throat and just pour it down. You don't want to swallow. Like, pour as much down as you can, as fast as you can. Because it had this salty, horrible, horrible salty taste. And so I got about 1/4 of that bottle down. My God. Any French fries around? No French fries? Horrible stuff. But I proceeded to kill that bottle. Then I went up to see my friend. CFR radio, and I had the other bottle under my in my sleeve. Us drunks carry our bottles in our sleeve. And I went up to see him, and he's doing a show featuring Billie Holiday. And I was in the room where they do the, where he does his deal, and he had me sitting on a chair overlooking Pigeon Park. And there are big, huge French windows there. And I'm sitting in this chair looking down that spot, a couple of guys I know. They're drinking real booze, like from a liquor store. And I thought, well, I'd like to have a drink of that. So I thought what I'd do is I'd go down and see them. Now this bottle of Chinese wine, it just hit me. Like real quickly, it just hit me. And it occurred to me, I was seeing things a little blurry. And as I'm looking out the window, I think there's trees there in that park. They got stairways there, one of those stairways, I don't like it, it's too slow. I thought what I'll do is I'll just jump on the tree and climb down and get a drink. And so I'm out there, I'm scared of heights. I'm out there on the window ledge trying to get ready to jump. This guy's on the radio talking about Billie Holiday, and he turns around, he sees me, and he thinks I'm going to commit suicide on his radio show. And so he kind of hollers at me, and I turn around, and he puts out his hand, and he's trying to get me back through the window. And as we're doing that, I lost my balance, and I'm giving her one of these. And if he hadn't grabbed my hand, I would have took a header into Pigeon Park and died there. And how fitting that, I thought, would be. Gladstone, you know, in the heading of the Georgia Strait, well, maybe in the second page. Gladstone takes a header in Pigeon Park, drinking Chinese wine. So every time I go by Pigeon Park, I kind of think of that. It reminds me how lucky and fortunate I am. Now, when I was trying to get sober, this damn book has been following me around all my life, this book. I first saw it when I was 15 years old, because my surrogate father at that time, and in one of these foster homes, was an alcoholic. And he had this book. And it separated our dresser. It was the marker. This half was mine, that half was his. And he used to go out and get drunk all the time. And one day he's getting all, it was UIC day, that was a big day for him. He got all excited, get all cleaned up and say he was going to go get a job. And I'd say to him, no, you're not going to get a job, you're lying to us, you're lying to all of us. You're going to go out and get loaded. You're going to come home, you're going to call your mother horrible names, and you're going to try and beat me. Why don't you read the book? And I'm a 15-year-old kid, and I'm pleading with him, why don't you please read the book? It says in the book on the first page, this is how 100 men have recovered from a seemingly hopeless disease. But why don't you read it? And he wouldn't read it. I never saw him read it. And he died drunk. And so what's really strange for me is that I know this book. And in all the treatment centers that I was in, they give you this book usually. And they talk about it all the time. And they want you to read it. Sometimes that you read it and they give you homework to write about shit in here. But you see, I got this hearing problem. And I got this ego problem. And I got this terminal uniqueness problem. Like, why would an intelligent, tall, slim guy like me have to do that? You know what I'm saying? I didn't need to do that. So I'd never read it. I'd never read it. And I've been in enough treatment centers, I knew the answers anyway from listening to guys who'd read it. And like, there's some pat answers. You know, for you new guys who haven't been around too long, there's a couple in here. I'll give you a couple tips. There's some really neat answers when people ask you stuff. Just say, let go and let God. That covers a lot of shit, doesn't it? Or another one, somebody asks you a problem, go to step three. That covers a lot of territory. You know, so I used to learn these quick answers to things. But I never read the book. I was in Skid Row again one time, living there for about a year. And I figured I finally got to a place where I could drink successfully. I hadn't been arrested for a year. I hadn't been robbed. I hadn't been beat up. Nothing had happened to me. And I thought, I finally arrived. I'm working at the lookout as a volunteer, makes me feel good, and I know I'm better than somebody because I used to feel that way, that those poor sick people in there. And I got pissed off one day because I was drunk and I used to roll dope in it, and it's good for a lot of things, I suppose. No, it is. I mean, some of the rooming houses I had, it was like a coffee table. You know, you're sleeping on the floor. If you put the ashtray on it and stuff, candles and stuff. A lot of good uses for this book. And so I got pissed off at this book, and I threw it out the window. Threw it out the window. And sitting there on Alexander Street, I come flying out of my place, and I look, and there's that damn book. This is a week later. And what's really weird about that, you know, is other drunks that see it laying there. And they kick it too, you know. They say, oh God, it's an AA book, oh my God. It's an AA book. They're dying of alcoholism, and that's what would happen. So about a week later, I kept looking at this damn book, and I thought, I can't even get rid of the damn book. So I picked it up. It's the same book. It's all wet and everything. Now about, well not about, it's 17 years old. Because I've held on to it. And I got to a place where I actually started to read the book. And the neat thing about that, when I was reading the book, and I didn't read it because I wanted to read it. Because after I got clean for 3 months, you know what happened to me? I couldn't hear anymore. My hearing just went, they're asking me to do all these things, I couldn't hear. Couldn't hear. But I sort of knew what was going to happen. And I knew the next time out, I wasn't going to try this anymore. The next time out, I got to that place. You know that place in your mind where you just can't take it anymore. You can't start anymore. You just can't do it anymore. And your mind, when you get sick, like when you get hungover, your mind just gets so ugly, so horrible. You want to, if you could automatically kill yourself with a thought, you would. But you can't do that. Like I just couldn't do it anymore. So I watched the sick men that came in with me. One of them's here. Davy had that problem too. Davey thought you're supposed to read Airport or something in treatment center. I'll never forget him. He used to drive me crazy with his Airport book and his headphones. And Dave's sober 14 years now because he took off the earphones and got rid of Airport. Picked up this book. And so when I read this book, I finally found out, reading it, page 45, I tell you the most important things. There's only two things in here that I think are of utmost importance. They stopped me cold when I read them. And one of them is on page 45. It tells me the main object of this book, the main purpose, the reason why they wrote the book is to help you find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. That's why they wrote the book. I'm glad I figured that one out. I'm glad they wrote that in here. I now know why they wrote the book. And you know why it's so thick? Because you got to pay $8 for it. And us alcoholics, we want a deal. So they make it nice and thick like that, you know? Throw in a whole bunch of stories and shit, you know, double the size, so you don't lose that sentence. Because that's the sentence. That's the essence of what we do. And as I continued to read the book, the next thing that impressed me was I wondered what you people had. Like, I just wondered what in the hell you had. You know, there'd be a guy who's sober like 6, 8 years, 10 years, whatever. My God, good to see you, Shane. 6, 8 years sober, and he'd be at meetings all the time, and you know, those guys used to make me sick. Getting fatter all the time. And they'd always be with the change in the pocket, you know, and the car keys and shit, you know. I'm so grateful and everything. Oh, I just hated those people. And now I'm one of them, you know? Just a skinny version, that's all. The next thing that impressed me was, it says, what we really have, what these guys have, what I have, what you have, every man in this room, every woman in this room, what we have today, and what we're going to want tomorrow, is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of your spiritual condition. It's tied in with that first thing I read. And the interesting thing is none of this talks about the drug. Doesn't mention the drug. So that's not the problem. I used to think that was the problem. That's not the problem. And I figured that out too. And as we proceed to read the book and get to that place, and, you know, looking at our lives, we start walking through these steps, and the steps are outlined in the book, and step one is about simply about powerlessness and unmanageability. And if we look at our lives, we know if we're in treatment centers or we're in our 15th job or we've had to move 30 times or, you know, it's our 10th girlfriend or whatever, you know, we wake up and we say, well, maybe, yeah, I'm powerless. Maybe I'm powerless. So maybe my life is a little unmanageable. And then we get to that place in step two. In step two, I hated step two. I never heard anybody talk much about step two. Step two is kind of a throwaway step. It's like one and three. Nobody talks much about step two. And so if we look at step two and it says, what does it say? Came to believe. I'm in the right place, am I? Came to believe a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. Thank you. You're paying attention. The word that messed me up in this was it said came. Now, I wanted to be an English professor. I know you probably don't believe me by the way I talk, but I read a lot of books thanks to the federal government. Yeah, I don't need to go any further with that. I read a lot of books. And so when I looked at that word came in step two, it's the past tense. Right? Is that right? Past tense, came? It's past tense to the word come. Right? It already happened. If it came, it already happened. So now, just so we understand each other, if I ask some of these younger guys over here, would you like to come or would you like to came? What would you like to do? I'm asking the wrong people. All these people over here want to come. Okay. Me too. That's not a hard question. So that means, oh my God, it already happened. I missed it. Well, step two was like that. It already happened. See, when I was at step two, I was in King Haven for 3 months and 1 day.
Now this is important. The one day is important. You see, I could stay sober 3 months. Done it many, many times. But I could never stay sober 3 months and one day. I couldn't do it. And I couldn't do it because I was restless, irritable, and discontented. That's what it tells me in the big book. Those are two big words to tell you you're unhappy, right? Pissed off, unhappy. You know, I become these meetings and see guys like Jim and see all these different old-timers and they piss me off. Because, you know, and I was unhappy. And I can't stay unhappy for longer than 3 months. I don't know about you. But that's my limit. And I know after 3 months what's going to work. What will work instantly is a drink. And I get to that place, I get that idea, and I'm gone. And nothing matters. And this is where normal people, so-called non-addicted people, they don't understand this. They just don't understand that. They don't understand what happens next. You see, if I get the idea that I'm going to have a drink, just that idea, then what happens is it doesn't matter about my kids. It doesn't matter about my job. It doesn't matter about where I live. It doesn't matter about my self-respect and my dignity. It doesn't matter about my freedom. None of that matters. I'll put all of that on the line because I don't have a choice. Because there is no way out. I can't. I just can't. I didn't know how. I could not drink. I could sometimes put it off. But it would always come back. And I'd have to. And all those things would happen and it would get worse. And I thought when I come around here that that didn't happen to you people. And then I found out that it does happen to you people. But that you can do something about it. There's something you can do about that. You can get well. You can recover. Recovery. What's recovery? I used to think it was always about quitting stuff. This is not about quitting. This is about getting healthy. This is about recovering something. What are you going to recover? I lost that book, right? I'm going to recover it. I got it back. I got it back. So what did I lose? Well, I don't know what you lost, but I lost my innocence. I lost it a long time ago. I lost it when I was just a little kid. You know, my parents, for whatever reasons, put me up for adoption when I was a week old. And you know, I thought, when I was asked about that lots, I thought, well, that don't particularly bother me. Because I'm a survivor. But you see, I understand today that that little child, that baby, when that happened, cellularly in my whole system, something traumatic happened. And I was hurt and scarred. And it was that was to go on many more times in my life where people left me. And so that feeling of being innocent and full of feeling like $1 million and joy and dignity as a little child. I had that, but I continued to get it ripped out of me. And that's what I recovered here. That's what I got back. You know, to feel that you are deep inside you, the core where you live, defective. To feel that you have to put on, if people really knew who you were, they would leave. To have to put on an act all your life. And I had all kinds of way of acting out so that you would like me. All I wanted you to do was like me. And if you were a logger, I'd talk about logging and skitters and all that logging skitter shit that they talk about. And if you were a mechanic, I'd talk about all that mechanical stuff people talk about. Whatever you wanted, I'd be for you. Because all I ever wanted was just to, for you to like me. And I didn't know how to do that. So when I come here, they told me I could recover. I could get that back. I could find out who I was. I could clean up the wreckage of my past. I could look at that. That healing could take place. I could get to a place where I'd really find out who I am. That's what recovery's about. And when you find out who you are, and you've got dignity and self-respect, you can stand tall. You can meet anyone anywhere and say whatever it is you need to say. You know, I need to talk for a moment. Whoa, can't talk too long here. It's 8:30. How long do I have? 5 minutes? I need to talk for a minute because I see a couple of the brothers out here. This was about getting brutally honest. And now I know some, you know, I'm going to have to tell you guys this. I'm a half-breed Indian. I know you don't know, believe that. What was your first clue? And I'm so, like, I didn't turn into a half-breed Indian until I was 39 years old. Actually, I turned into a half-breed Indian in these rooms. Because before that, I was a Chinese. I was half Chinese. And if you didn't believe me and were drinking screech with me, you wouldn't tell me that. You just knew not to tell me that. And so for 39 years, denial is one of the most wonderful things. Because I look in the mirror and I'd see a white man. No, I would. All the time for 39 years, saw a white man. When I got to King Haven, it occurred to me, to talk about honesty, I couldn't stay sober. I could never stay sober. What I needed to do is I need to be brutally honest. I need to talk about something that I had a hell of a time talking about. I need to tell people I'm a half-breed Indian. But the reason I had so much trouble with that is there's an adjective that precedes the word Indian in my circle. And that word is drunken. Drunken Indian. Who would ever want to be a drunken Indian? I couldn't join that fraternity. I couldn't do that. So I had to lie about it. And why do I have to say half-breed Indian? Anyway, I'm a half-breed white man. No, right? Well, it's just as valid, right? Yeah. I know why, because you made the rules. You white people made the rules. And I'm changing them, okay? You met your first half-breed white man right here. And you know what's really neat? Ever since I've been a half-breed white man, I haven't had a drink. And that's weird, isn't it? I wonder how that worked. You know, I was telling some, it's so nice to see, I work in a treatment center. I just need to close with some of the wonderful things that have happened to me in this outfit. I was single all my life, still am. I have this relationship problem, I don't know what that's all about. We're working on it. I'll be at the dance, okay? I was in Pigeon Park one day. A guy reminded me of this. And I was so sick. I couldn't, you get to that place where there's just no energy. You can't move. I just sit there. And it's those times when you see a bro and they come along and they offer you a drink and you know there's a God. And I was sitting there in that condition waiting and thinking of suicide. And I'd been in the back alley for a couple weeks. And some strange thing happened. A bus stopped. And about 5 or 6 kids got off the bus. And they were about 12 or 13 year old kids. And I could hear this noise. This strange noise of laughter, of innocent, clean, untarnished, pure, sweet, musical laughter. And it just threw me. What is that? Because in Skid Row, you don't hear it. There's no kids in Skid Row. And I looked over and I saw all these kids. And they were playing and joking and messing around the way kids do. And I'm looking at them, and I'm 39 years old, and I'm thinking, you poor sucker, Lloyd. You've missed it all, man. You'll never have kids. You're too old. You're a drunk. You're a Skid Row tramp. You think you're so smart. You've missed all the important things in life. You'll never have a small child say to you, hey, Dad. Dad, will you be there for me? You'll never hear that. Well, what happened in recovery? And I particularly want the guys that are in treatment now and the people that are just coming back, I want you to hear this. Particularly if you've relapsed a whole lot of times, and if this is your 10th, 11th, 12th time, I want you to hear this. Like your wildest dreams. Your wildest dreams. You see, we don't dream when we're on Skid Row, when things are falling apart. You can't. You don't. It's a survival thing. You don't allow yourself that. There is no imagination. And so my dream, I would never dream of children. I'd never dream of a happy house with the fireplace and all that stuff. I couldn't. It hurt too much. But what happened in my recovery was a guy with 29 convictions, a guy who looks like me, worked. I mean, I used to work social services, you know what I mean, for the extra checks and stuff, the damage deposits and all those things. Well, one day, in Abbotsford, I had the minister of social services, Claude Richmond, call me up to a podium in a room much like this and shake my hand for all the work I'd done working with foster kids. I'd had 13 foster kids live with me for a period of 6 years. And I wanted to tell him, Claude, you don't know whose hand you're shaking, buddy. I couldn't have dreamed that dream. And I got it here. I got it here because you people, no one else, like, I hate it when people pat me on the back for my sobriety. Because that's not what it's about. See, I had no place else to go. This was the only place. No one else would take me. The nut houses wouldn't take me. No, nobody would take me. Jails, they wouldn't even lock me up. I would always end up in an AA place. And you people, I did everything I could. I stole from you. I called you names. I swore at you. I badmouthed you. And what did you do? You people are nuts. No, you are. You said, keep coming back, Lloyd. I said, I stole from you. Keep coming back. Thank God you said that. And thank God there was nowhere else to go. Because I've got such a full and wonderful life today. You know, I'm not a foster parent anymore in that sense, but in a sense I am. I work in a recovery house and we have about 42 men there. Some of them are relatively young men. They're coming in younger all the time. And I have a sense sometimes when I'm working with those men and I'm talking to those men, these young men, I feel because we're all brothers, that they're like my sons, and I hope, I desperately hope the best for them. And what is it I can tell them? How is it I can help them hear what it is we need to hear? Because what happens to them out there today is more terrible than what happened all the years I was out there. And so, please, hang on to your chair.